This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. Today, I'm honored to be speaking with Professor Vincent Lloyd. Dr. Vincent Lloyd is an associate professor of theology and religious studies at Villanova University. Today, he's here to talk with us about a book called Black Dignity, The Struggle Against Domination, which was published by Yale University Press. And his previous books include Black Natural Law, and he also co-edited Race and Secularism in America. He also co-edits the journal Political Theology. Vincent, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Thank you. It's such a great book, and I have a lot of questions. I've already sent you the questions, and I guess you could tell that I had a lot of questions to ask. But before that, I'm really interested to know more about your background, your field of expertise. What made you become a professor of theology, and specifically what attracted you to this to the idea of writing about political theology and also the cause of the Black people in the United States?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So I started out when I went to college thinking I wanted to be a scientist or mathematician, but then I discovered I was interested in lots and lots of different classes, lots of different topics. And when I was taking courses in religion, I was able to think about many different topics at once, to think about philosophy and anthropology and history and art and the human experience in general. So I found that, not only by studying religion could I examine lots of different topics that interested me, but also I could study something that really mattered to the lives of people. While I was in college, I was involved in some labor organizing and getting involved with some unionization efforts. And it was great to see the religious communities getting out in support of those social justice issues. So that made me all the more interested in studying religion. And then later on, when I went to graduate school, I thought, the particular way that I want to do this is to not think specifically about or exclusively about religious traditions, but to think about the big questions that religions are after. And those questions are often philosophical questions. What is the good life? How can we flourish? How can we live together? How can we pursue justice? As a Black person in the US, those questions were inflected in a particular way for me. From my own experience growing up in the U.S. and then entering the academy, I wanted to bring the tools I was gaining in the classroom and in my own studies to these questions that really mattered in my own life and to those around me about justice and about struggling against anti-Black racism.
And what was the story of this book, Black Dignity? I'm guessing Black Lives Matter also played a role in creating this book. But did you have the idea of writing the book before that, or is it something that happened afterwards?
Yes. So there are a couple answers to that. One, I'd worked on an earlier book that was published called Black Natural Law, where I was looking at the invocations of God's law or a higher law in Black political thought and seeing that as central to the tradition of Black political thought. So we might think of Martin Luther King as someone who invokes God's law, but actually Frederick Douglass, Anna Julia Cooper, Jesse Jackson, all sorts of figures, even W.E.B. Du Bois, who's often seen as a secularist, is invoking God's law or higher law, even coming from a kind of sociological perspective. So I had been thinking about what are the moral foundations of Black intellectual life and Black justice struggles. But the story I told in that natural law book was kind of a sad story, right? Once there was a robust natural law tradition that paralleled, but also was importantly different from the European and Christian natural law traditions, and then it went away. And in the 70s, 80s, 90s, we don't hear this natural law language around Black justice movements anymore. So that was a kind of sad story, but then Black Lives Matter happened. I noticed that, you know, that sad story doesn't fit the reality, right? That there is all sorts of energy. There is all sorts of moral vision coming from Black political movements on the ground, often youth-led, often led by women and queer folks. I wanted to think more about where is that moral vision coming from? If it's not coming from a tradition of natural law or God's law or higher law, where might it come from? Well, I kept noticing, I noticed repeatedly this language of dignity in the first line of the Movement for Black Lives platform, in the names of organizations under the Black Lives Matter umbrella, in the speeches and writings and tweets of activists involved in the movement. So I thought, well, maybe I should rethink this story about the core of the Black political tradition. Maybe it's not best told as a story about higher law or God's law, but instead a story about dignity.
It's a fascinating story. And also you start the book with this story around Frederick Douglass. And in that story, you talk about dignity, struggle, and the fact that why it's dignity is the heart of the Black struggle. So I'll leave it to you to talk about this. This is such a fascinating story. And I'm originally from Iran myself, and I do follow the political struggle of women in Iran. And I love that sentence in the book, the dignity is in the struggle. So I would let you talk about that story, Frederick Douglass' story. And then it would be great if you could talk about your definition of dignity. What do you mean by dignity in this context? And how is it different from respectability or other similar sounding concepts?
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. And it is exciting to see how this language of dignity travels so widely geographically and also historically, or that it's a language that pops up in lots of different contexts and that can suggest that it's powerful, but also can be confusing, right? Because it seems like dignity is being used in different ways. So part of the challenge of this project was to look for some coherence in that language of dignity. And to do that, I wanted to look at a foundational text in the Black intellectual tradition, probably the most sort of towering text of the 19th century Black intellectual life, that is autobiographies of Frederick Douglass. He writes his life story three times. These are texts that become foundational for the movement to abolish slavery, but also become foundational for the Reconstruction movement, the movement to rebuild and reweave the democratic fabric of the U.S. after the Civil War. Frederick Douglass was born in slavery and eventually escaped, became a leading activist calling for the end of slavery. But the way that he had the biggest impact was in these stories of his own life that he wrote. And in each of these stories of his own life that he wrote, one episode is always at the center. It's a moment where Douglass transitions from being fully understanding himself as enslaved, right, as a slave, as an object, as something like an animal. Then something happens, right? Something sort of snaps in him. His master, Edward Covey, tries to grab him, tries to whip him, tries to bind him and sort of physically attack him. And instead of just submitting, as Douglas had always done in the past, and as was expected of him, Douglas decides to fight back, physically fight back, to grapple with Covey, and they wrestle on the in this barn in a scene that Douglas vividly depicts and then retells in the subsequent autobiographies. There are other interesting characters around. Covey tries to call on other enslaved people to help him capture Douglas, but those people say that they won't. Douglas uses his body to fight, but he also uses his words and reasoning to try and trick Covey. And eventually they come to a standstill. Douglas doesn't escape at that moment. He's not free, but he realizes that he's more than just an animal. He's more than just an object. He's more than just a slave. He is a human being, and in Douglas's own words, he has dignity. He realizes that he has dignity through this process of struggle, physical struggle, grappling, but also intellectual struggle, also community building, right? It's through his relationships with the other enslaved people that he could count on them to come to his aid, or at least not help Covey. So there are lots of multiple dimensions of struggle, but that struck me as really important and distinctive, to think of dignity as struggle and struggle against mastery, right? Struggle against, in this case, a master trying to treat another human being as a slave, but also mastery as such, right? This phenomenon of domination that we find all over the world at different moments of time in all of our lives in different ways, in different extents, on scales large and small. This struck me as, what ought to be the starting point for any analysis of dignity, to think about dignity as a struggle against domination, which is quite different from traditions of dignity that see dignity as something like aristocracy, something like nobility, right? A kind of high rank, the dukes and the duchesses and the kings having dignity and the poor people not having dignity. That was one older conception of dignity. But it's also quite different from this sort of universal conception of dignity that we find in Kant and also some Christian traditions and other religious traditions, where just by nature of one's humanity, one has dignity. In this case, dignity is something, in the case of Douglas, and I think more generally in the African-American tradition, and probably more generally the Black tradition, see dignity as something that is done, right, in struggle, right? It's not something that's had, it's not something that's possessed, but something that's performed. And so attuning ourselves to that different sense of dignity that Douglas's story so vividly captures and helps attune us to, I think, is really useful in reorienting how we think about dignity.
And it's in that sense that you mean dignity is performative. It's just not a state like respect or respect that you usually associated with the nobility.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, there are, I think, in this Black conception of dignity, elements of the universal and elements of the aristocratic, those two earlier conceptions of dignity, and that because we all struggle with domination in our lives, right? We all dominate and we all are dominated in different ways on a scale small and large. We're sort of subject to these giant forces in the world of capitalism and patriarchy and also small on a small scale in our lives. We have bosses, we have parents, we have others who dominate or even when they ought not dominate us. You know, this is something we all struggle with, and so we're all struggling with domination in various ways. Sometimes we're quite passive about it and just sort of accepting it. Sometimes we're quite active about it and trying to creatively respond to the domination that we're encountering in our lives. So there's a universal element to Black dignity in the sense, but there's also a kind of a differential element. Right? There's some people who are struggling more, in this case of Douglas, where his very humanity is on the line. Right? If he does not struggle, he will be effectively an object or animal. If he struggles, he will realize his humanity. But in that case, there's a greater magnitude, I think, of this kind of struggle. And we ought to respect that as we might, as in olden days, they might have respected an aristocrat or a bishop or some person of high rank. So keeping both of those older senses of dignity in mind does seem important to me, even while sort of reading them through this conception of Black dignity as struggle against domination.
There is another question that I have. The oppression is it's has always been a part of human history. So it's African-American oppression, sexual or religious minorities go through these women. There are still women who are fighting for their freedom, who are fighting to free themselves from oppression. In the book, you say that we need to recognize the distinctiveness of Black oppression. And also you go on to say that Blackness is the ultimate paradigm of dignity. So I'm curious to know more about it. Why? What is so distinctive about Black oppression?
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Yeah, that's a great question. And I've been, you know, as I've been having dialogues about this book with folks in different contexts, ranging from South Africa to different parts of Europe and Latin America, it's been really interesting to hear ways in which stories about domination and struggle are read differently in different places. And in some of those contexts, there's some suspicion of centering Black experience when talking about dignity and domination. The reason I think it's important to center Blackness is not just about our current political moment and the fruitfulness of the social movements around anti-Blackness, which I think are generating deep insight as well as power, right, to affect transformation that other movements ought to learn from. But actually, I think the more important reason is, you know, the long tradition of sort of theorizing domination, of trying to figure out what domination means, has always taken slavery as the paradigm case, right? From ancient Greece and other sorts of ancient contexts, where to the present, right? When Dominus is the master, right? It's a problem of mastery, and if we're worried about a problem of mastery, we need to be thinking about it not just in the abstract, but particularly in the problem of slavery. You know, from there we can understand cases of prisons, cases of patriarchy, all sorts of other cases. And when we're thinking about slavery, you know, the ancient world slavery is quite complicated, right? It's embedded in different economic systems. There are forms of family relationship that persist. It varies a lot from context to context. The paradigm of slavery, I think, is at least that's useful for us to think through, is the Middle Passage, right? When African folks are being enslaved and taken to the Americas. And that strikes me as a paradigm case because the entire identity of the enslaved is as enslaved. Relationships to family, language, religion, land, wealth, everything else, right, are being stripped away. And all that is left is the slave in pure form, something like that. Obviously, that's not entirely true, right? But we're talking about the closest to a paradigm case as we can get. So if we want to sort of study domination in laboratory conditions, right, with all of the complexities sort of bracketed, the case that we ought to reflect on is this case of the Middle Passage, I think. And, you know, if it's domination that we care about in our own lives, in the lives of, you know, others in various parts of the world, and across time, you know, all of those reflections, I think, are usefully routed through the Middle Passage, because that's the moment where we can clarify for ourselves in our own thinking, in our own politics, what domination looks like and how best to respond.
There, I have also a question about Black philosophy, let's say. There are people, and I don't agree with them, but there are a lot of people, sometimes even well-meaning people, who say that we're still creating hierarchies. And it's not only with this. For example, when I come from, again, Muslim background, so when people talk about Muslim philosophy, I say, oh, what do you mean by Muslim philosophy? Philosophy is philosophy. You are creating categories or distinctions that don't really exist. So but what is Black philosophy here, and how is it different in general from philosophy as we know it, and what does it aim to achieve?
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Yeah, and I think this there's a kind of empirical sense of this question, right? Where does one find people saying that they're doing Black philosophy? And you know, this is something that I think is emerging in the academy in recent years, where there are certain philosophy departments that are training people in a tradition of African American philosophical reflection, or sort of Pan African philosophical reflection. Which I think has a lot of potential. There are sources there, ways of thinking there, questions that get asked there that are not attended to fully in other philosophical spaces. I think that's really important. I think the risk of carving out that sort of corner of the philosophical academy and as African-American or Pan-African or Black philosophy is that philosophy becomes just contextual philosophy. I think some of this has happened in the theological world where there's a claim that all theology, all approaches to a religious tradition happen through a particular context, which seems like it's missing something really important about the claims of a religious tradition to universality or to the importance, having importance for everyone, right? And having life-changing potential. Similarly for philosophy, if one is just saying, there are traditions of European philosophy, there are traditions of Latin American philosophy, there are traditions of African American philosophy, and so on. They are each distinctive in various ways. They each respond to different questions. One is missing something that makes philosophy so exciting, which is that it's supposed to ask these deepest questions that everyone is asking, right? And all over the world, across time. And it's supposed to sort of dig deep into the meaning of justice and love and anger and the good life and so on. So, I think it's important for me and exciting, I think, in when I see people doing this, to read sources that come from a particular context, but are making claims that are universal or making claims that go beyond that context about, what wisdom really is, but what justice really is. And that's what I see happening in this Black philosophical tradition, that there is a very particular experience that's giving rise to the kind of reflection in figures like Frederick Douglass or Aimé Césaire or Senghor or Martin Luther King or others, including those who are located within the philosophical guild in the academy. And yet, right, there are also these universal claims that are being made and claims that what the insights of Black philosophy are actually superior to the insights of other philosophy, right? They're taking into account the sorts of questions that were asked in European traditions of and Christian European traditions of philosophical reflection. They're taking into account of that. They're saying those questions and answers get things wrong. They're missing important things. We understand what Kant is saying. We understand what Hegel is saying, but we want to do something different. We want to focus somewhere else. We want to push the conversation in a different direction. So that's sort of how I think about Black philosophy.
There is another concept that has been around for quite some time now, and you touch upon that in the book as well, Afro-pessimism. And how do you define this concept, and how is it similar or different from Black dignity?
Yeah, that's a great question. Afro-pessimism captured the public imagination in the U.S. and I think beyond when in 2020, right around the time of an eruption of Black Lives Matter protests during COVID, Frank Wilderson published a book called Afro-pessimism. Frank Wilderson had been writing about the topic and using the phrase for maybe a decade or so before that. But this book sort of captured a mood. And there are a couple of senses of that, right? One is a mood as opposed to a set of claims or intellectual project. And, I think appreciating that mood is really important, right? That we're in an era of climate change, in an era of Me Too, in an era of, increasing awareness of police violence and the continuing legacies of colonialism and much else, right? Hope doesn't seem like the right language. Sitting with that darkness, sitting with the deep systemic interconnected problems that we face today, it seems really important. And that language of Afro-pessimism as a kind of mood, I think, is capturing that and is helping to bridge some social movement discourse around Black Lives Matter with academic discourse. There's also a very specific kind of pragmatic reason that Afro-pessimism earlier, when Wilderson and his colleagues were first sort of using the language, went into circulation, which was the discourse in the U.S., and particularly in California, which is a state where the race question is not a black and white question. Like, there are huge Asian American communities, there are huge Latin American communities. So Wilderson and those around him in California were saying, all of the kind of race politics here is about people of color, and it's about building coalitions. It's not talking about the specificity of the black experience. And we need a language that helps us to label the specificity of that black experience. So that seems important to recognize and remember as well. And then finally to address the question more directly, I think that the claims around Afro-pessimism are usually about the exclusion of blackness being constitutive for the modern world, that is, sort of pushing away or ignoring or subjugating blackness, where blackness involves black people, but also black things and the stuff that swirls around black people is necessary for and makes possible our modern world, our contemporary world, has been an ingredient in European thought, Christian thought, other traditions of thought that often goes unrecognized. And because the problem is so deep, right, it's constitutive, right? Anti-blackness is constitutive. It can't just be a little policy fix here or there that is the appropriate response to anti-black racism. Right? There has to be, as first Aimé Césaire and then Wilderson, quoting Césaire, say, an end to the world, right? The world as we know it is based on anti-blackness. This is a claim, and then to fix the problem of anti-blackness, the world has to end, and we have to imagine a world beyond the end of the world. So that's a pretty dramatic claim. In some ways, I like to read it pragmatically, right? That there was this particular California problem that these folks were responding to, and as a political maneuver, it's helpful to say, actually, the problems faced by Asian Americans in California and by Latinos in California and by Native Americans in California and by Black Americans in California are different. There's something very specific about the problems of Black Americans, and we need to tell big stories, dramatic stories that help focus our attention on that. That seems right. It also seems like there's something generative about imagining the way that racism is linked with systems of thought. Even as that's a big claim and a claim that's not something you could prove or disprove, I think it's a claim that opens the imagination or helps us notice things that we might otherwise not notice. So that seems useful about Afro-pessimism. In contrast, though, right, in this book, Black Dignity, I want to start with social movement discourse, right? Start with those who are organizing against domination, those who are organizing against anti-Black racism, take their language both today and in the past, in this tradition of struggle against anti-Black racism, take that language as authoritative, even as it's defeasible, even as it's not always right, it's something that we should turn to, and to really focus on social movements vision and power of Black social movements as not redemptive, but the best place we can turn to understand everything about the world, not just some particular aspects of the world. So in some ways, it's a flip side of the Afro-pessimism, right? The Afro-pessimism is kind of sad story, primarily intellectual story, that says anti-Blackness is connected with everything. I agree, there's racism connected with everything, but that could be a happier story, right? We can see the movements against racism as movements that are helping us transform the world as a whole in the direction of justice, and not just movements that are pushing against one particular problem, that is anti-Blackness.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
All right. Let's talk about multiculturalism and liberalism. You are very critical of them. And I remember I saw a video clip of the late Malcolm X, who called a liberal a fox. That was, I don't remember when it was recorded. So why are you critical of multiculturalism and liberalism? Do you think they have been conducive or have helped the cause of African Americans in the States?
Yeah, so thanks for that question. And Malcolm X is, you know, as a wonderful orator and has really powerful things to say about the limits of liberalism. So does Martin Luther King Jr., right? Yeah. The letter from Birmingham Jail is directed to the white moderates, the white liberals, the ones who think that, you know, with enough conversation, with enough listening to each other, with enough sort of opening up to our difference in time, we can resolve the deep problems that the nation faces. And Martin Luther King, like Malcolm X, is saying, no, right? There are times when we confront moral abominations and we need to say, this has to end, right? This isn't a time for further discussion. This isn't a time for hearing everyone's opinion. This isn't a time for bringing everyone to the table. This is a time to sort of put our bodies on the line and say that there can be no more of this this abomination that was segregation in the South, and that we can see versions of that in various social movements in different parts of the world. So, in one sense, Martin Luther King and Malcolm X are sort of giving reasons, this sort of sense of urgency that the sort of liberal imagination is inadequate to our moment. And it feels like this is increasingly the discourse of younger folks, right? That in an era, as I was saying before, of climate change, of patriarchy, Me Too, colonialism, et cetera, there's a sense of urgency, right? A sense that, you know, if we don't act now, we may not have a chance again to act, right? Which climate change brings so much into focus, but which, you know, we ought to feel about police violence, about prisons, about other issues as well. Traditional liberal political imagination isn't up to that task. That's sort of one side. Thinking about multiculturalism in particular, at least in this book, I try and think of a kind of periodization where, you know, there was which is focused on a U.S. context, but I think maps into a post-colonial context as well. There's a sort of era of protest where racism was named as a legal problem. Then, you know, those that push was in part successful and part unsuccessful. It radicalized in the U.S. There was a Black Power movement, Black Panthers and others. You know, in post-colonial context, one finds other sort of versions of this radicalization, especially when there's violent struggle involved. And then we enter into an era of multiculturalism, 80s, 90s, and aughts in the U.S. And I think the period, the dates are a little bit different, but I think things like this happen in other post-colonial contexts and in other metropole contexts. There's a sense where remembering of ourselves as a nation or as a people, as one that had sinned, recognized the sin, and then recovered from it, right? Now we have all sorts of different people who can work together, who can be included, who can share their traditions and their foods and their games and their clothes, and we'll appreciate how everyone is different, but we can all be together. Right? This manifests in different ways in different places, but I think it had a whole lot of ideological force in the U.S. for three decades. And that during those three decades, Black justice did not advance. During those three decades, the statistics about education segregation, about wealth inequality, about pollution in Black neighborhoods, these statistics are not getting better. They're getting worse. Right? So this ideology of multiculturalism, which seems like it's a kind of happy story, everyone getting along, we solve the problems, actually is just masking the problems, right? Freezing our capacity to address them, because It's telling a story about problems as things of the past that have now been addressed and are now being memorialized. So, you know, that strikes me as the problem that motivated the rise of Black Lives Matter and similar movements in the 2010s, in the U.S. context in particular. Barack Obama sort of promised to be the realization of multiculturalism. He embodied physically multiculturalism, being the son of an African father and a white mother from Kansas. He was multiculturalism. Now that was ruling the U.S. And yet, police violence was increasing, was increasingly visible. Prison population was still it was still huge and disproportionately affecting Black folks and poor folks, et cetera. So seeing that disconnect between the triumph of multiculturalism and the facts on the ground, particularly for poor and marginalized and Black folks, getting worse and worse, led to this sort of eruption. And now I think my book and others are trying to theorize that break, right? Say, what will come after multiculturalism? That was a paradigm. We're at a moment of paradigm shift. It's not clear what the new paradigm will be, right? We see the cracks in the old paradigm. We see it's not addressing what it's supposed to address. It's incoherent. We're setting it aside, but what comes next? And I think that moment of paradigm shift that we're in now is causing a good deal of the uncertainty and fissures and internal tensions within social movements, as well as in broader political discourse, because it's not clear what the new paradigm will be.
When you responded, I was reminded of James Baldwin, you know, who there was again this video of him who said that you always tell me it takes time. It took my parents' time, my grandfather's time, my nephew's time. I don't remember exact quote, but it was again, I guess, a criticism of this liberal idea of just getting in dialogue, you know, to solve the problems. Anyway, what is Black political theology? And again, when I was reading your book, I was very much reminded of the idea of liberation theology. Is it close to that, or is it different from that?
Yeah, so I wear a couple of different hats, right? One is that I teach in the theology and religious studies department here in the U.S. at a Catholic university, although I'm not Catholic myself. What theology and political theology mean in that context is one quite particular sort of thing. And what Black political theology means in a social movement context is quite a different sort of thing. So I'll address the latter first. And you know, I would start addressing that by noting that you know, there's often a story told about the recent wave of racial justice movements that says these are secular movements. You know, in the 1950s and 60s, there were Christian ministers and Jewish leaders and other religious leaders, Muslim leaders, Malcolm X and others, who were on the forefront of these racial justice movements. But today, we see unchurched people, we see young people, we see queer folks who are alienated from all religion, who are at the center, on the front lines of these movements. So there's something true about that story. Certainly the optics have changed, and there aren't men, sort of Black men wearing suits and clerical collars who are leading the charge. But on the ground, there still is a whole lot of engagement with religion in various forms in these movements, right? There is the use of religious infrastructure, church buildings, and use of clergy networks and so on. To support movements. There's also, most importantly, from the perspective of this book, a religious language, and particularly a sort of spiritual language that circulates around these movements. So a language of spirit and faith and imagining impossible futures and something like, redemption. It's a language that draws on a variety of different religious traditions in the U.S. context, often is heavily influenced by Christianity, but not exclusively, is, I think, recently self-consciously drawing on African traditional religions and incorporating those practices and languages into social movement spaces, Black social movement spaces. So that, in a sense, that is Black political theology today, right? It is, you know, these social movements that are eclectically drawing on different spiritual traditions to address the political problems, anti-blackness and related issues that they confront. Sort of taking off that hat and putting on the more official scholar of theology and religious studies hat. There's a long tradition, not that long, maybe half century tradition within the academy of doing Christian theology from a Black perspective. So James Cone is often seen as a founding father of this movement, but there are a series of figures who are really instrumental in making space within academic theology for Black reflection, both in terms of systematic questions around who is God, what is the relationship between Jesus and God, and so on, from a Black perspective, but also ethical questions, right? How ought religious folks, and in this case, particularly Christians, respond to this problem or that problem? In a sense, that is Black political theology, but it's also being inflected recently by the pressure that's put on those academic spaces by social movement spaces. Those academic spaces had energy in the 60s and 70s and have in some ways routinized that charisma, right? They keep doing what they were doing from the 60s and 70s and write books about it and write articles about the other people who wrote articles about the other people who wrote articles about it, right? This thing that academics do of sort of keeping a conversation going, which can allow participants in the conversation to take their eye off the ball, right? There's actual anti-Blackness happening now. There's police violence happening now, right outside our windows, right? There are almost 2 million people kept in cages in the U.S. right now. So I think we're seeing Black political theology in this sort of disciplinary sense, having to reimagine itself by the pressure being put on it by social movements who are very much rooted in those realities of poor and Black folks in the U.S. today and beyond.
And you have talked about this throughout this interview, that religion and theology has been at the heart of Black struggle. But at the same time, there have been people who, like James Baldwin, who have been critical of the role of the church. And where do you see the role of secularism in this struggle against domination?
Yeah, it's a great question and a tricky one. So a figure like Baldwin proclaims himself to be alienated from or distanced from the church, and yet his literary and intellectual life is totally determined by religious categories, right? He's pushing against them, but they're also shaping how he sees the world and how he writes about and represents that world. The depth of influence at the level of conceptual imagination and affect and style, right, of religious traditions on Black life, Black intellectual life, Black philosophical work. I think it's hard to ignore. That being said, this question of secularism is one that I'm particularly interested in, because there was this wave of scholarship on the question of secularism that largely grew out of anthropologists interested in Islam, and particularly in Egypt, Talal Asad, Saba Mahmoud, and others, who were making the claim that secularism in those contexts is a political tool of the West, of imperialism, of liberalism, and religious movements are pushing back against secularism, and by pushing back against secularism, they are doing politics, right? Because by pushing back against secularism, you're pushing back against all the connected ideologies. So there seems like, that strikes me as quite compelling, at least to think with and argue with. And there has been relatively little of that kind of conversation traveling to the context of race in the US, right? Obviously in the European context, it's different because sort of the Islamic studies discourse is mixed in with questions of race and racialization. But in the US, the sort of study of Black religion is operating in a different world, and often not very conscious of questions of secularism and the way that secularism can be entangled with ideologies of whiteness, ideologies of liberalism, ideologies of empire. And I think that the sort of scholarship and critical thinking on that is just emerging. So I do think it's important to be careful in our analysis of social movements to like neither embrace the secularist reading of these movements or these sort of intellectual projects that are implicit in the movements, nor to do the other secularist move, which is to caricature religion and manage religion by caricaturing it and saying this, that's what we find here, right? Martin Luther King is Christianity, or some Malcolm X is Islam, something like that, right? Which is also getting religion wrong and limiting its potential, containing its potential by playing with a kind of cultural fantasy. So, I mean, I think these are things that we need to beware of in our analysis, and that I try and avoid in the book, but I think are really tricky to navigate.
Let's talk about the idea of resistance again, resistance to domination. You talk about ontological resistance to domination. What is an ontological resistance to domination? What are some examples of this form of resistance to domination?
Yeah, thanks. So I think I try, although I'm not always consistent, to invoke the language of struggle as opposed to resistance. I worry that resistance is a quite freighted language, and the kind of Foucauldian critiques of resistance are, you know, get something right, that, you know, where the resistance may take all sorts of forms that we don't imagine and maybe almost impossible because of the ways that we're complicit in systems, right? So struggle, to me, feels vivid, right? In this sort of Frederick Douglass example, we see struggle physically happening or depicted to be physically happening. We also, I think struggle evokes labor union strikes, right? A kind of struggle for better wages, it invokes sort of even the quiet and small scale struggle that we have in a workplace against the boss, right? Which might be directly against the boss, or might be slowing down our work, right? Or not doing exactly what the boss says because of the relationship of domination with the boss and the sort of broader system of capitalism that the boss points to. So that language of struggle, I think, is meant to help us notice these different sites, including silences, which can be a form of struggle, right? If there's a discourse that one is expected to participate in and one refuses by being silent, that strikes me as a form of a struggle. I think the language of spiritual struggle is really interesting as well, and evocative and useful. I don't know exactly what it means, but it seems interesting to think about prayer as a form of struggle, which again might be a kind of struggle within oneself that reconfigures one's own orientation to the world in a way that's misaligned with the powers that be, and so is a form of struggle against the powers that be. So those all are examples of struggle. What I mean by ontological struggle is struggle that's oriented against domination, right? So there are all sorts of struggles that we have, and we struggle in a very loose kind of sense. Struggle to lose weight, struggle to get to work on time, struggle to get the kids to go to bed on time, or whatever it may be. And those are not all about domination. So being able to tell a story about domination and move between that story about domination and the particular practices seems like the really tricky thing, and the thing that I'm trying to commend and offer some examples of in the book, right? How can we sort of offer this picture of a system of domination, which is fairly abstract, by relating it to a paradigm case, the case of the Middle Passage, and then thinking about struggle against this rather abstract system in this variety of ways that range from very active and direct protesting and holding a sign to indirect aesthetic, musical struggle, silence and struggle, etc.
Again, in the book, you talk about new moral vocabulary emerging around Black Lives Matter. And I really love the way you have named your chapters. You have the chapters are called Black Rage, Black Love, Black Family, Black Futures, Black Magic, which is another incentive for people to read the book. It's a very easy book to read and very, very informative as well. So what is this new moral vocabulary that you're talking about? And then maybe you could also talk about, I have a lot of questions from these chapters, but maybe we should talk about a couple of them. And I'm really interested in the idea of Black love.
Sure. Yeah. So, I worry that philosophers, that the methods that we use in Black philosophy ought not simply replicate the methods that are used traditions of European philosophy. That is, starting with ordinary language, conceptual analysis, even the sort of deep reflection that one gets in Heideggerian traditions, or the sort of conceptual work that dialectical work that one gets in the Hegelian traditions. You know, that all seems really useful and productive, but needn't be the starting point for Black philosophy. And so the sort of experiment of this book was to say, you know, what if we start with the not ordinary language that one hears on the street, but the ordinary language of a protest movement, right? The kind of slogans on posters, hashtags on Instagram, activist speeches, and chants. You know, what if we take that as authoritative? What if we take, if we believe that social movements are the best place we have to look for a vision of justice, you know, for a true vision of justice, then we ought to start with the language of social movements and work from there, right? Figure out what it's trying to say, what it gets wrong, where it's incoherent, but always return to that language of social movements that are pushing in directions of justice. So I tried to organize the book, as you point out, according to different key slogans of, circulating around Black Lives Matter. Those I didn't aspire to be exhaustive and treat all of the slogans, but I chose these slogans because I thought they addressed issues that are of perennial interest in philosophy and in sort of philosophy in the broadest sense, right? Thinking across history and across geography about truth and goodness and beauty and so on, and how to live well. So I saw these hashtags as occasions to enter in from this Black perspective into those perennial dialogues about big questions.
What about Black rage? How can Black rage generate solidarity? And I'm deliberately asking this because there are a lot of, like I said, well-meaning people who want actually racial justice, but they say, well, look, this rage doesn't do a thing. We need to still get into dialogue. We need to talk. But there, as you mentioned earlier, there are times that, no, you need to be rightfully angry. So how can this rage, that rage, generate solidarity?
Yeah, so on the one hand, the word rage sounds like it marks a person you don't want to be sitting next to. On the other hand, the term righteous indignation sounds like someone you do want to be friends with, right? Someone who has righteous indignation, is someone who's noticing things about the world that others haven't noticed, and they're upset about it, and they want to transform it. If we sort of sit for a minute with indignation, right, it's about dignity not being respected, right? Going against dignity, right? Indignation. So that's a sense of rage that I wanted to reflect on and to ponder in that chapter. A sense of rage that occurs not at a particular act that was committed that makes me upset, but about the limits of my ability to name the things that are getting me upset, right? This seems like a really important difference between anger and rage, right? If anger is about particular acts in the world, and rage is about something much deeper, right? Some feature of our conceptual world that limits our ability to speak about what is upsetting us. And so we can only scream, we can only rage, we can only seethe with negative affect, which doesn't need to be stuck in negativity, but can find at its best echoes in others who are also feeling alienated, who are also finding that the dominant discourse, that the way that people are talking about some feature of the world is, you know, has no space for them to express what matters to them. So in the case of anti-Blackness, right, until very recently, there was no space in the discourse to talk about prisons as a problem. Right? The question was just, how many new prisons can we build? How much can we lengthen prison sentences? So for those who have family members incarcerated, right, how is one to relate to that discourse? Right, the only thing one can have is a kind of rage because there's no space to name the apt reaction if there's no space in the discourse. And by finding others who are raging, other family members of those incarcerated, who are also seething with this kind of deep second order anger, one can say, why are we both so upset? Well, there's a system that's excluding us from the conversation. Let's see what we can do together about that system.
And is that what you mean by saying that we all need to become abolitionists?
Yeah. So this language of abolition is circulating more and more widely in the last decade or so. It seems really promising to me in many ways that we're remembering how quickly people's consciousnesses could transform with respect to slavery. Mm. That over the course of a couple of decades, most Americans, and I think similar things happen in different parts of the world, thought slavery was, you know, not great, but also, you know, not something we need to act on immediately. Abolitionists as a social movement transformed that, right? It made most people think, we need to do something about slavery. This is a moral abomination. That sort of spirit of a committed movement transforming public discourse seems really powerful, and I think it's what prison abolitionists are doing, and why that language is being picked up much more widely beyond just the case of the prison. I worry sometimes that it's a little unclear when that language is expanding what we're supposed to abolish. Is it authority or is it domination? I think too often, especially I want to say especially younger folks, but I think people of all ages are guilty of this, you know, are upset about authority, right? Without really thinking this through, right? Authority is something that we need as a practical matter in our lives, right? We treat the dentist as an authority, right? Authority with respect to our teeth. The problem is domination. The problem is those who enjoy their authority too much, right? And so you arbitrarily exercise their will on others and drive pleasure from that, and so do it more and more. Domination is a problem, and abolition as a political vision is a vision of a world without domination. One that there's no clear path from here to that vision because domination is so baked into the world as we have it, but it's still crucially important to imagine together what that world without domination would look like. And that's what I think an abolition vision is trying to do.
As a last question, is there any other book or project you're currently working on?
Yeah, so the project I'm most excited now is thinking about the concept of abuse. So I think I have the bad habit of writing a book and then spending a lot of time thinking about what's wrong with that book. In a sense, that's what got me working on this Dignity Project. I worked on the Black Natural Law Project, and then I saw I got things wrong, right? I told a sad story. I told a story of Black justice movement decline. That's actually not the story that needs to be told or that fits the world. So similarly, I think with this Dignity book, you know, I worry that focusing so much on slavery and domination can erase the variety of forms of ill treatment that we find in the world. That domination is important, but it's not the only kind of bad behavior. I think Gen Z, the younger folks, are doing a great job of highlighting all sorts of bad behavior that previously went sort of under the radar, things like gaslighting, right? Various forms of, Me Too related, practices. These strike me as better described as abuse rather than domination, the project I'm working on now is trying to think about what would it mean to have a pick out abuse, not use the word very loosely as it is now. Anything we don't like, we call abuse, but actually think about it as a very specific kind of phenomenon in the world that doesn't have the same paradigm case as slavery. It's not based on the Frederick Douglass paradigm. It's actually about entangled wills, right? About the abuser trying to make the abused think that they have the same interests when actually they don't, right? And the violence that happens when those two wills are entangled. So that's what I've been thinking about these days.
Well, it's a great habit. It keeps generating new books, right? Dr. Vincent Lloyd, thank you very much for taking your time to talk with us. Really, really enjoyed this conversation. And I strongly encourage our listeners to read the book. It's an easy read. And like I said, it gives them a lot of food for thought. And what I particularly liked about the book is true that you talk about the distinctiveness of Black struggle and dignity. But what I found great about the book was its universality, because I felt that I'm not like saying what I had experienced or what I witnessed is anything similar to this, but I could see the points of the commonalities. I could see how in other parts of the world, this idea of becoming abolitionist, this idea of resistance to domination, all echoes with their struggles as well all over the world. Thank you very, very much for your time.
Thanks for having me. Take care.